What do you do if you do not find inherent goodness in yourself? I think certain traditions, it is said that the emphasis is in perhaps seeing how much negativity there is and then to try and purify that. However, from the Buddhist approach, a lot of emphasis is given in pointing and encouraging you to recognize the inherent basic goodness. Whether we start off with a much more simple term, Buddha nature, human nature, basic goodness, or using much more the mantra approach, mantrayana approach, and referring to it either as primordial wisdom or enlightened mind or Buddha nature. Now, all of these different terms or designations that are given point to the importance placed by Buddhist teachings to recognizing and gaining confidence of one's own basic nature. But as your question says, it is true. Simply being told about an inherent basic goodness may often become very difficult for a person and for all of us ordinary people, because the prominence of the impact of negativities sometimes becomes very strong. It is very dominant. So what are we likely to be more believers of? Something that's very apparent, has a reference, has an immediate effect, or something that is spoken about, which we would like to believe in, but may still be very elusive and very invisible to us. So in such a case, although approach to the path, the progressive approach to path of meditation, all of the methods, especially in Vajrayana tradition, the methods are designed in such a way that one gradually is capable of recognizing and becoming more confident of the basic inherent goodness. For example, even the simple aspect of receiving empowerment, what you are empowered with is the capability to have and place more confidence in this basic goodness. And then that confidence allows it to be unearthed or generated and made much more strong. So even the lineage transmissions, oral transmissions, receiving teachings and the transference of lineages. Why is that important? It's also in order to build the confidence. Taking refuge is a very beautiful, skillful means through which you begin to place your sort of step into recognizing a better ability than that what previously one may not have been aware about. So whether it is bodhisattva vows, whether it is the samayas and the commitments, all the different kinds of methods of practices in Vajrayana, such as creation and completion, visualizing and meditating on form and formless meditations, all of the peaceful and the wrathful approaches of practices are primarily with the intention that these methods assist the mind in having greater enforcement, strength, and insight that leads to then having the confidence of the fundamental basic goodness. So since the Dharma itself is presented with that intention, relying upon a lot of the practices that you do and seeing that as a very important method that you have, and sort of using the method skillfully to recognizing the inherent goodness becomes essential. More simply put, the question, inherent basic goodness won't pop out just because one is a Buddhist. It should, given that it is only covered as long as the bubble of delusion doesn't burst. So wherever the deluded concepts are able to be burst through your own insight, through recognizing that it is what it is, as long as you make it, And it is what it is as you have designed it, as you want it to be, as you have projected it to be. Then upon the bursting of that deluded concept bubble, then inherent basic goodness does arise. But in order that it be there, something that you can gain more confidence in, a much more progressive approach is very important. And perhaps because of that, cultivating good qualities is the closest to reaching the core of the inherent basic goodness. So one also again sees the absolute wisdom and the skillful means, the kindness of the great teachers, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in how much they have encouraged you to generating positive qualities, recognizing that you can be patient, recognizing you can be generous, recognizing you can be more resilient and diligent, recognizing that you are able to exude the prajna, the wisdom within one's own self. These qualities are like the radiance and the luminous radiance of this core sun. The inherent basic goodness can be seen as the core of the sun. But the core of the sun manifests, radiates light, luminosity, warmth. In the same way, the qualities that you are able to generate, the qualities that you are able to present to yourself, to the others, should be seen as manifestations of the power, radiance of the power of the core of the inherent basic goodness. So I always say the very simple things. For example, if you are driving down the road and you find this morning, like the nuns driving, and they found a small chipmunk eating on the road. And so you stop the car, and it's full of Buddhist nuns. So little chipmunk makes a lot of these uptight nuns, not always, sometimes. I always joke with them, so they know I don't mean it seriously. But sometimes it's good to keep that in mind, nevertheless. Very happy. So today is a good day, and I think it has much to do with the chipmunk there on the road. However, what I'm pointing out is, when you see something like this, when you see a chipmunk, when you see a baby, when you see beautiful birds, when you hear a melodious song, when you see a kind gesture, your heart immediately connects to that. It makes you happy. That itself is the biggest indicator of basic goodness. A natural inclination and identifying of a positive quality. You are immediately able to connect with that moment of gentleness. You're able to immediately find, for no apparent reason, you know, you don't see the chipmunk as your mother of your previous life. It's just sweet. And that permeates in your own mind. That itself should be also seen as the presence of inherent basic goodness, simply because it is the dominant quality in your mind. All the adversities, the negative emotions, are repulsed, and the repulsion that one has towards negativities, that itself, again, is another indication of the inherent nature being good. And so that's why teachings always say, everyone wants happiness, nobody wants suffering. Why is that stress so much? It's because of this. It's because that what you are naturally inclined towards is happiness, because that's your nature. What you do not want, have some repulsion towards, is the negativities, because this is alien to your nature. But of course, it is still something so powerful that we continually create, and that's the ignorant aspect of it. So that's why the inherent goodness is to be seen this way. When you see it this way, and then work with progressively, as I said, by maybe still working with uncertainty about the basic goodness, but highlight, emphasize, strengthen positive qualities, good qualities. With the strengthening of the good qualities, it will be able to diminish the shadow of what are alien to your basic nature and bring you closer to the possibility of recognizing fundamental inherent goodness. So that is one question. Who or what is it that recognizes or perceives no self? Oh, very good question. We'll leave it at that. I'll go through the text and then come to this point. Where do we draw the line between self-cherishing and a sense of self-esteem? There's no difference. Self-cherishing and self-esteem, there's no difference. Yeah, I know the English, you all trick, you all use all these big words and you trick a lot of teachers. So that's not good. In English, low self-esteem is something that you all do use. I am familiar with that term. But eventually, it's still... Now, I'll always have to give you a choice. Do you want me to be polite or do you want me to say it as it is? Say it as it is, then there is no difference. Yeah. To be polite, and of course also to take it on from a practical approach. Some people really lack in any sense of self-esteem. There is no pride, no courage, no sense of ability to see goodness in one's own self. That's worse than abject arrogance or having tremendous self-absorption and self-clinging. It's very, very bad. Therefore, that is as negative. Now, beyond the common answer that is given, just as what I have mentioned, Dharma perspective, low self-esteem is arrogance. Arrogance is low self-esteem. There's no difference. When you're really insecure, weak, have no idea of any good quality in you, the more you do that, the more proud you are, the more arrogant you are. So, low self-esteem is another self-cherishing attitude. Coloring is different. Like you put makeup in the same way, the coloring, the makeup is different. But otherwise, bottom of both of these are tremendous. One may be more hope and the other may be more fear. Self-cherishing demands. It's hopeful. It's very demanding. Yes. Low self-esteem is poverty mentality. Hungry, craving. So, sometimes children demand from parents, give me. If that doesn't work, then you sit on the ground and you throw your legs and begin to yell or cry, a tantrum, and you get it. But in terms of the very core factor which instigates all of these displays is self-grasping, self-cherishing attitude. So self-esteem, in the sense that you do recognize fundamental Buddha nature and the ability to go beyond self-cherishing attitude, if you are referring to that as self-esteem, then that's very good. But the term self-esteem itself can be misleading. That's the problem here. So instead of saying self-esteem, why not call it basic goodness? Nature good as it is, and being true to that, if you are able to do that, if you recognize that fundamentally the nature is good and you need to be true to that, one would not have to even say self-esteem is important. It is evident that the confidence will naturally arise in such a person. Self-cherishing, self-esteem, the word both of them can again mislead to point that self-esteem does seem to be a little bit more entangled in a tantrum that demands some care, some giving. So because sometimes we say when there is self-esteem is an issue over here, people often say doormat. The other day, I think Kala Chakra or somewhere, somebody asked me, how can I avoid being a doormat? And I was in a hurry. So I said to her, there's no problem being a doormat. And then I left. After that, and then Jatunla, my sister afterwards, then in the car said to me, why did you ever say that to her? Because the poor person, you never know the situation that she may be in. And sometimes people, when we say it very quickly, and I agree that I should not have answered the way I should have, I did. Being a doormat can be misunderstanding. Here, self-esteem is what we are talking about. So sometimes people think, and Buddhists do that very often, you're so afraid to grasp. And that makes you really unhappy Buddhist. Your practice is a little bit good, you beat yourself up for having thought it was good. So you should not have any attachment. You feel a little bit happy, oh, I'm getting arrogant, I shouldn't be arrogant. There are some who dwell in that happiness and bliss and arrogance. That's the other extreme. But now here we're talking about self-esteem, so the much more the pessimistic attitude that is there. Then in the such a case where you are being overly cautious about everything, there is an underlying current of another disturbing emotion that comes, which may not be arrogance, but something else, which may not be the sort of attachment to the happiness, but the fear of the attachment, fear of the happiness to the expression of the attachment that you are feeling at such a point. So carefully, one has to watch oneself and see all facets of the trickiness of one's own feelings and emotions and be able to be a little bit lenient with your own self. Because as I said in the morning, feeling the emotion is not the problem. Dwelling and prolonging the emotion can be more disruptive, can be more disturbing. When you are so cautious, so afraid that you almost pretend you're a corpse without feelings, without emotions, and if you do feel them, if you do have emotions, you're creating, grasping, and clinging and so forth. Now in the teachings, of course, we talk about letting go and realization of shunyata. If one is capable at such a stage, then yes, but we're talking about our level, my level. My level where shunyata and emptiness is still very much an intellectual theory, not so much what I'm able to really recognize, really realize. At such a point, you have to be a little bit more kinder to yourself in knowing senses and senses, sense consciousnesses will contact sense objects. You will have a feeling, you will have an emotion. If you are having a good session of meditation, there is no harm in feeling good about it. Don't dwell on it. Don't prolong that. In the same way, when you are feeling an emotion of self-pity, that's okay, but don't dwell on it. Don't prolong it. So being able to have a healthy attitude to your own minds, wisdom minds, cognitive capacities, or what is called the vividness of your own Buddha nature, must be allowed. Buddha nature, since it is termed to be emptiness, isn't like a small, let's say, mice in a dark hole called emptiness, afraid to pop out its head because it's going to grasp. So if you just keep yourself too much mousy, with everything that is arising, then that is a very fabricated zero instead of realizing what emptiness truly is. Emptiness liberates. Realization of emptiness makes you happy, able to relate to everyone without an agenda, with everything that arises without an agenda. So that makes the relationship much more beautiful, much more constructive, much more liberating. Now in terms of the doormat situation here, then sometimes people, because of not really seeing this, because of the very linear way of looking at emptiness, then people do think, oh, I should not have any ego. And because I should not have any ego, you become a doormat. Now if that is misunderstood, then it's very unhealthy, because you know, eventually the doormat is going to cry. Eventually the doormat is going to feel very much in a situation full of injustice. And there is then aggression that builds up, which can be more explosive and destructive to self and the others in the long run. Therefore, one must not be so deprived of the wisdom that looks at things more clearly. But eventually, you do have the potential of becoming a doormat, happy doormat. Doormat that is not going to feel you are sacrificing something, because there is nothing to sacrifice in the first place. So when I said, yeah, there's no problem in being a doormat, I mean it in that way. Eventually, that whom you call the Buddha is the best doormat. See what we've done to him. All bodhisattvas are the doormat. I'm being very disrespectful. Among Tibetans, this would never be said, but Western language is such that you can probably play around with that word. So, what I mean by is, when you think about letting go of self-cherishing attitude, what does it involve is that you are like the basis of the earth. And so when Shantideva says, may I become like the element of the earth, the basis for all sentient beings, you're willingly, happily encouraging yourself to becoming courageous, to becoming a very large doormat. Isn't it? So there's no problem in that, I think. So, however, here, I think, underlined is, it's the attitude, it's the perspective, and your mind's capacity to relate to things as they arise is what your potential at the moment is. You have to have a very clear and an honest understanding of what you are capable of doing now, work with, in tandem with that potential. Don't take more than that. But having said it, realize tomorrow you can do better. Next year, greater capacity. Today become 1 inch mat, doormat. Next year, make the doormat 1 foot wide. Gradually progress so that the mind becomes a basis that can hold others without the hope of having to assert self everywhere. So, be generous. I've never said, or none of the teachers have said, let the self be generous. We've always said, be patient. There's never a teaching that says, let the self be patient. Be able to be kind to the others. But don't deposit a self over the kindness. I am going to be kind is not the statement here. Being kind is what is being spoken about. I am going to be compassionate is not the plan here. Nothing but compassion. That is how one should look at it. So that is one. Then an email came, although I said internet doesn't work, but I thought it was interesting, because this is a question that is there in many people. It's a long question, but it says, we often hear that we should let go of disturbing emotions. Though I have often experienced Dharma practitioners who totally disassociate from their own negative actions. When someone confronts them with the notion that they feel wronged by them, they totally disassociate from their own actions, claiming that the other person is having an ego-clinging problem. This might in some circumstances be true, but this does not leave much space for working towards solving a problem regarding both the parties. It can lead to the fact that only that one party withdraws from any further dealings with the other, since it is not always possible to work together if a genuine problem exists. So since I am not enlightened in any way, I assume I can make a lot of mistakes on the path of practice and in my relationship to the people and beings. So I might as well find my own share in a matter to uproot my disturbing emotions. This is where I see the 12 Vidhanas at work, and I can implement the teachings in my view. Rinpoche, you have said that the 12 Vidhanas from 1 to 12 causes samsara, and from 12 to 1, nirvana. Therefore, I see working backwards with my disturbing emotions will yield the same effect and eventually stop all disturbing emotions, since working constructively will result in the wisdom of the disturbing emotions. However, perfect Buddhists, and with them, I experienced the ego thriving on perfectionism. And it goes on a little bit. Now, that's very true. I wanted to take this question among several of them because this is something that we all need to be very careful about. Language of spirituality builds up psychologically some kind of a spiritual supremacy, spiritual ego in our own selves. And we never realize as practitioners how arrogant we become, even in trying to do something good. And then language is very prominent, and we use a lot of things like, you should deal with your karma, or this is karma. And we use it very conveniently. In the same way as this person has said, who's a very good friend of mine, and we often talk about this, is about the abject sense of arrogance that we Buddhists have, where we always want to point out the faults of the others. And we always say, well, when it is something that we have to assert, we say, you should work with your ignorance or ego grasping. You should be the one to look at it in a much more compassionate way. When the force of that person's argument is more strong, direct towards one's own self, then we say, what can I do? It's my karma. Isn't it? So those are very wrong things to do. I wanted to bring up the question, not for an answer, but I did want to create a reminder for all of us, and particularly for someone like myself, to be very careful that any view that we hold must be something that is embodied in our attitude and in our conduct. Each one of us who have heard the teachings must truly embody the teachings in our own actions. Otherwise, we will tell people to let go, to be kind, to be compassionate, but may not necessarily be able to put the mirror in front of our own selves and see how we are reacting, how much letting go we are practicing. And so being not so lost in the profoundness of all the very pithy and the profound views, but being very practical, very down to earth, very honest in your approach, where compassion, letting go, non-ego grasping, letting go of ego grasping, all of these are sincere practices that we are able to cultivate, that which is felt and is evident by the others. And so we always say, we others or sentient beings are not clairvoyant. They don't know how well-meaning your intentions are. Most sentient beings, not being clairvoyant, will need to see it, will need to hear it, will need to feel it, and therefore one must always work with one's own self. You must never forget, as Padru Muche and all of the teachers have always said, one must never forget placing the mirror in front of one's own self, seeing how one is acting, how one is working with, and taking that to the path of practice. However, when you encounter such situations where you see what we call obnoxious Buddhists, arrogant renunciates, or very wise and learned lazy people, all of these paradoxes that are there, that are very, very sad, but they are there. We're all there. I'm not talking about somebody else. I'm talking about my own self. When we all sink into these kind of contradictory behaviors within our own self, then there is pain. We feel very, very sad when we find a Buddhist being unkind. We see it's very difficult when we see aggression among Sangha members. But at such a time, always take the right approach. One is take it as a way of now looking at how much an opportunity you do have to practice your own basic awareness, your own patience, your own compassion. And so as our teachers have said, regarding all adversities as the manifestation of your own teacher, being able to see that as a better opportunity in challenging oneself to see how can you do it differently that is causing you so much suffering and pain in seeing in the others. So how are you different? How can you be different is by taking that with greater awareness, with greater patience, with greater kindness. More importantly than that is to take all adversities that you see as a way of educating yourself, gaining insight in your own self, the truth and the wisdom of the Buddha's own words. This is what ignorance can create unnecessarily. Whenever you see adversities, you should always take that as a way of further confirming or gaining confidence in seeing how powerful human ignorance can be. Self-cherishing attitude can, despite so much learning and practice, if blind a person to that degree where he or she has seemingly has no care or concern about the others, then what can be said about other sentient beings who may not have as much learning, as much understanding? Therefore, one more reason to quickly abandon self-cherishing attitude. One more way where you begin to shake your head and say, that's the extent of what destructive negative emotions can do for a person. And therefore, take it in a positive way. Take it and build something good, something positive. And so as the Lojong teachings always teach us, all adversities can be the best of friends because they teach you not to take things so complacently. That the self and the self-grasping and the ignorance that it breeds is so powerful that it has managed to build this web, intricate, complex web of all the different realms of existences. The very best of the things happen because of this mind. The very worst of the worst things also happen because we have managed to give in a lot of input into it, into the build-up of that situation. So causes and conditions are contributed by all of us. Of course, like any light switch, all the wirings that are there in the building, but it takes one switch to put them on. Karma is something like that. We contribute causes and conditions in all kinds of ways. It's very intricate and connected to one another. It just is a matter that there has to be somebody who switches it on, and the experience is experienced by everybody else. So factors and dominating factors are there, but otherwise, all of that what we experience, good and bad, are contributed by every sentient being. And where the dominance is negative emotions, negative causes and conditions, then of course the suffering does increase. And learning that to arouse within oneself a greater aspiration to find cessation from suffering of cyclic existence is then taking adversities in a positive way. So those are the three questions that are here. And so very briefly, I'm going to sort of ask you to go through a small, brief meditation with me in accordance to what is then called meditation on self-liberation. So sitting as comfortably as possible. Sitting in the exact way that you assume to take on responsibility for all sentient beings. Somebody who is going to embark on a path, a journey of finding cessation of suffering for all sentient beings from ignorance, how should such a person's posture be? Everybody says meditation posture. Now, what is meditation posture? Meditation posture is simply the awareness of becoming someone who is aware of the responsibility that you carry. So without the dramatics of a straightened body, if you can sit like that, very good. But honesty must begin with the posture itself. Don't start this journey in trying to find the absolute truth by letting the body itself become the basis of a dishonest, fabricated approach. Sit kindly, sit with awareness, sit allowing oneself to balance between laziness and pride. Be able to have honest approach, generating the aspiration that through any insight and any effort generated to bringing about this insight of recognizing one's own true nature, may all that what is simply a creation of my busy mind and its habits of keeping many assumptions, may all of those assumptions fall apart, and may I be able to realize true nature as it is. So allowing body, speech, and mind to all be simply here, now, within one's own self. And as Padromich says, reflect upon fundamental nature as it is said to be beyond any structure, it is not seen, you cannot feel it. Therefore, drop the idea of seeing it. It is not formed, and therefore there is no need to have a strategy or a plan to see what mind looks like. Primordially expansive. What is this expansive? If it is confined in the hope and the expectation to see it, to touch it, to feel it, to be able to articulate it, then you cannot see the limitlessness of it. To be able to see the expansiveness of mind, let go of the hope to seeing it, the intelligent mind's wish to articulate what it is, senses, expectations to see, smell, touch, taste, feel it, resting, allowing it to be completely pervasive, letting awareness become vast, open, resting it by allowing it to dissolve as limitlessly as a space. There's nothing to see, so don't look for it. Tongba main reaching sal. Yet, it is not just non-existent. Everything else that you feel, that you can see, that you can experience, that is also mind. You can see, but under the seeing, there is nothing. You can hear, but below the hearing, there is nothing. You can feel, but beyond the feeling, there is nothing. You can think, but beyond the thought, beneath the thought, the basis of the thought, there is nothing. Rest the mind in appreciating this expansiveness where there is nothing, and yet fully alive with all appearances, with all sounds, and with all thoughts. Ritong yerme khatacha. Like the space that holds everything, like the space that holds this shrine, like the space that holds all of us, like the space that holds my body. Mind holds everything. Everything that can be seen, that can be felt, that can be touched, that can be thought. Like clouds and clusters of clouds that move from one direction of the sky to the other and dissolve into the sky itself, not deterring the skyness beyond the clouds. In the same way, sights, sounds, taste, smell, texture, emotions and feelings, thoughts, move in the expansiveness of the sky from one direction to the other, arising from this expanse, displayed, manifest in this expanse, and then dissolving like a wisp of smoke into the space, this too dissolving within the expanse. Sha jang te de teme santhal zho. Placing mind in awareness, where is there to place? Ma ja tang yang rang sar kor. It seems sometimes that if left, it seems to go somewhere, but where does it go? It's here. That which seems to go is also mind. That which seems to stay is also mind. In its staying, you cannot see it. In its not staying, you can still feel everything. kāngā mē chāng kūntu chū, tāngā mē chō rāng sarkhor. It has no legs, it has no limbs, but it's everywhere. If I say lhāsa, it's already there. If I say your home, it's immediately there. If I say upstairs, it is already there. If I say here, it is immediately here. Recognize the rapidness with which it can move, although without any limbs. But even if you were to send it far away, it's always here. It's always present. Recognize. Far, far away is also your mind. Close by is also your mind. Long time ago is also your mind. Now is also your mind. Yesterday is your mind. Tomorrow is your mind. This afternoon is also your mind. Make it big, important, easy, nice. It's up to you. Not important, not happening, not here. What? That's also your mind. Recognizing is also your mind. Not recognizing is also your mind. Just as it has no limbs, mind has no eyes. But it can see everything. Seeing is your mind. Agreeing with what you see is also your mind. Not seeing is also your mind. Therefore, it is impossible is also your mind. Happens is your mind. Doesn't happen is also your mind. Recognize the power, the wakefulness, the gamut of manifestations that this mind, which cannot be seen, is empty in nature, can generate. Search for this mind and you will find nothing. Just as you grab space and upon opening your palms you see you have not gotten anything. Likewise, look for this mind. It is no different than trying to grasp and grab a pocketful or a palmful of space. It is not there, and yet yoba mind tomparto. It manifests everything. Every appearance, every sound, every thought is the vividness of this mind that cannot be found. Tongsol chukurang dang sal. Within this expansiveness that holds every manifestation, rest the mind. Rest the mind in wonderment, being struck, astounded with the extreme number or extreme gamut of manifestations that it can create. What is there that we believe in that is not contained in this essentially empty mind? Empty is also here. Not empty is also here. Within that empty, everything is there. In that being everything, nothing is there. Resting the mind in such an expansiveness that holds everything. Breathe naturally. Bring to one's own awareness that this is the state that is closest to our basic nature. Relying and abiding inseparable from this spaciousness allows oneself to be able to be one with all manifestations. letting things be as they are, letting all thoughts arise and dissolve within this state, and then staying for some moment. But very interestingly, but Rumbuchi also says, did I ever think that within this expanse of emptiness, there is something called stinginess? So playfully, Pat Rumbuchi in his text says, Tombanila Sername, how did I forget that emptiness, nature of emptiness, doesn't actually have something called stinginess? Since when did I begin to think that avarice, that stinginess, that tightness of the mind actually existed and was not part of mind's own assumptions that it is there? We think, Trulbeye Wangi Serna, Machul Serna Lunkentu, we think there is something called emptiness, there is something called stinginess. That thought alone is the basis of our belief, which sustained makes us believe, have trust in that assumption that there is such a big destructive emotion called stinginess, so ferocious, with fangs, with horns, with tail, demonic in appearance, coming from the west, the east, so fearsome, so very wrathful, that I am finding ways in how to actually defeat the stinginess. Is it really true? If one looks carefully, nature of stinginess is nothing other than what I have held, other than what I have thought exists. If I let go of the thought that even calls it stingy, beyond that thought itself, where is stinginess? Does that mean stinginess lives as long as I think it does? If the concentration shifted more to the nature of emptiness, that is able to release and let go of a simple thought without my participation, without my encouragement, without my interference, can from somewhere else a thing independently existing called stinginess actually become so big that it begins to be displayed in front of my eyes? When one looks at this way, one finds that that is not true. Seeing the empty nature of the thought we have temporarily called stinginess, allowing it to be free, liberating that thought to be another thought, not exaggerating it by giving it any other particular name, letting it pass by just as clouds arise and sink into the expanse of the space, such a thought that creates a momentum of tightness, if liberated into seeing, liberated by seeing, this is also a thought, without my indulging it, this too shall pass. At such a moment, one begins to see that by itself, that thought which we think is stinginess doesn't have any power of its own. When that thought ceases and one is able to rest in the emptiness of that thought, this is then to be recognized as pure patience. There is no greater patience than the realization of this. In the same way, when anger arises, there is there, questioning yourself and seeing, is there an anger that comes from the external side that forces itself into your own body and then comes out through your mouth, breathing fire and looking ferocious, strangulating you, dominating you? Is there such an anger truly existing? If one looks carefully, there is no such thing called anger. Were you to travel the 10 directions, were you to go through all the realms of existences, one would never actually find anything called anger. You think there is, and that's what makes it be. If it is merely founded upon your thinking it is there, and one is able to go a step beyond that thought, then we find, other than a supposition, there is no real one anger existent. So therefore, what does it mean? Is anger only as long as I hold a thought to be? If I release that thought that there is such a thing as anger, that what I am feeling, the sort of rising of different sensations, is anger. If I relax the interference and the build-up of suppositions, what happens? One finds what great masters have said, nothing really happens. Then what is the nature of anger? Is it simply my conjured supposition? Or is it truly there? If it is truly there, one should be able to see it. One should be able to find it. One doesn't find it. So one knows, one sees. It is, anger is what you make it. Anger is as you will keep it. Anger will be what you will make it. Beyond your own interference and labeling and building and distorting a simple thought, what is the nature of anger? Knowing such, should one relax into not contributing to the makeup, to the build-up of a simple thought, there is no anger at all. Mind that is able to be free from aggression, mind that is genuinely nothing but kind, is such a mind. There is no compassion, so to speak, to catch, hold, display. This itself is compassion. There is no anger, something negative, destructive, to overcome, to throw, to run away from. Resting here and knowing this empty nature of a thought itself is the most important way of liberating neurosis, negativities, and being able to remain within one's own true essence. What is ignorance? In the same way, emptiness doesn't have ignorance. We think it does, and as long as we think it does, it seemingly appears, and we pump into it all the energy, all the concentration, and begin to construct many different factors that we very conveniently simply call ignorance. Nature of ignorance is empty. You look for something called ignorance. Where is there such a thing called ignorance? If you were to rip up all the floorboards, if you were to go through each of the things within the shrine room to search for the ignorance that we are trying to remove, one would never find ignorance anywhere. The existence and the power of ignorance lies not in its being existent, but in the supposition of your mind that believes it to be so. Relax that thought and see where is ignorance. Therefore, seeing it in this way. All emotions, the text goes into many different, all of the afflictions. But in meditation, leading, resting your mind in questioning that. Whatever is most aggravating at this moment, whether it is unkindness, whether it is anger, desire, whether it is hope or fear, whether it is pain or happiness, whether it is praise or blame, whether it is obtaining or not obtaining, whether it is gaining victory or loss that we are afraid of. What are all these things? We've made them strong simply because we've held on to the notion that they exist. Beyond mind's blind faith in their existence. What is the nature of anger? What is the nature of ignorance? What is the nature of desire? What is the nature of jealousy? What is the nature of ego, arrogance? We suppose them to be, as long as the supposition lasts and we feed into the supposition, they are there. They become powerful because you sustain them. But if one looks at what its true nature is, what the true nature of all these emotions are, and we take one step deeper into seeing beyond your own perception of what they might be, what is truly there, one doesn't see anything. One doesn't see or find anything. Like small wisps of an incense that temporarily swims in the expanse, gradually dissolve into the expanse of space. Thoughts arise, thoughts dance, thoughts cease into this expanse, keeping the mind more and more inseparable from the very basic expanse, that which is limitless, that which is free and beyond any periphery, any expression. But nevertheless, holding everything. In the expansiveness and recognition of the expansiveness, resting, relaxing, becoming more freer in your abiding, in seeing the vividness and everything that it holds, finding a little bit of humor and sense of happiness, sense of embracing everything that arises within this expanse of emptiness. If a meditator can rest a little bit in such a state, then the depth of the mind of the person gains greater strength and familiarity with the natural expanse of the Dhammadhatu mind, the very expanse, sky-like mind. However, in that expansiveness, where with humor, with kindness, with a sense of embracing everything as it arises, if one is able to relax into that kindness, genuine sense of peaceful equanimity that is sincerely kind towards all appearances arises. Recognizing at that moment that this is what you are capable of doing and manifesting. It is the natural expanse that is limitless, that can hold everything. And being able to keep that, familiarize it, making it more strong, allows one to then have the basis of bodhicitta, basis of true Buddha nature, which then is much more powerful and one of the most powerful ways of being able to embrace and skillfully engage in everything as it arises, but without being sucked into it, without being drowned by what it encounters. When one loses touch with one's own basic nature, then what happens within the framework of the mind becomes so very interesting, so very strong, that the impact completely fools the awareness. Just like a person watching a movie, and when something pops out from the movie screen, and everybody jumps on their own seat and thinking, you have the same kind of emotion. Or when you watch something sad and everybody weeps, that is the moment where you have lost the sense of separation between real and what is happening in a theater. So we say people who are not so emotional, often husbands will look to their wives and say, don't be silly, don't cry. That's not happening really, that's happening on the screen. Those who are able to look at it more objectively then are those who are not sucked into what is ever appearing on the theater screen. It is in the same way. Where the ground basis of your own mind's fundamental nature is not what you are able to keep in touch with, then whatever arises within the framework of the mind, like a theatrical display, becomes so very important, and you get drawn into it, and you cry with it, you are happy with it. Towards some you have great fondness, towards some you have great animosity. And just as one would be persuaded by everything that is happening in a movie, likewise one is persuaded by all the different experiences that we experience, that we create in this conditional existence. However, if a person were to be able to keep in touch with the ground basis of the emptiness nature from where all appearances arise, then such a person is able to relate and respond to every appearance. But one is not so drawn into it to that degree that the sanity is completely overwhelmed by the appearances. Wherever the basic sanity is overwhelmed and sucked into the appearances, neurosis immediately manifests. That's the separation of the basic space and the appearance. Duality arises because of that. So instead of that, if the mind is able to be trained through samadhi, through meditation, in slowly teaching it to remain within one's own inherent expansiveness and to view all manifestations with kindness, giving them the freedom to express, not killing, not dissolving, not destroying appearances, but freeing them to manifest as they will. Just as you give freedom to the clusters of the sky to arise in the expanse, likewise giving freedom to all the clusters of thoughts that does cross through the sphere, framework of your own mind, but not following them, not holding on to them, not manipulating them, not interfering with them, but letting it arise on its own, manifest as beautifully as you will, and that itself being compassionate. And when it is dissolving, letting it just as beautifully, gracefully dissolve, arises within your mind, manifests within your mind, dissolves within your mind, thoughts arise in your mind, thoughts abide in your mind, thoughts cease in your mind, the nature of mind itself expansive, resting in that and then gaining familiarity with it, building that up to becoming the reference that strengthens you. In the beginning, you see it. Then it becomes a reference. The reference gradually becomes so familiar that you become it, and that is becoming the natural nature, where you embody the natural nature, realizing the natural nature. When that reference itself becomes so permeated that it becomes non-deliberate but natural, then within that expansiveness of the mind resting, one is able to cut ties with the different neuroses, the different kinds of negative tendencies. So, working with that, taking all of what you understand, what you have recognized or what you have heard and practiced in your Buddhist practices and teachings, but taking them all to this one single awareness becomes very essential. Sitting shamatha should lead to this understanding, vipassana should lead to this understanding, visualizations should lead to this understanding, vows and samayas should lead to this understanding, creation and completion, form and formlessness, all of the different levels of practices should all be practiced in order to bring about this potential within one's own self. And if you look at it that way, then one doesn't even necessarily have to be a Buddhist to be able to do this. Fundamental basic nature is not copyrighted by Buddhists, must be also understood. Therefore, being able to have the courage to inherently know one's own basic nature, that is then one of the most crucial ways of working with not exaggerating emotions so much. So I will stop here and encourage each one of you to work with your own mind, having, as I said in the very first talk, meeting with the Dharma, obtaining the precious human existence, and then meeting with the Dharma. And not only meeting with the Dharma and the wonderful teachers, but also having the devotion and the wish to practice are all very rare opportunities. All very good, all wonderful, but each of these wonderful things will not be able to be utilized if ultimately you do not train your own mind. And so these are all rare and difficult to achieve, but the rarity and all of the greatness of these qualities must be brought to fruition by thoroughly investigating, working with your own self, working with your own mind. So it is with my prayers, best wishes, that there be no obstacles in your path of realization, that each one of us have the confidence of knowing that to realize absolute truth, one will have to begin the journey by being very honest with our own selves. So I hope that that happens in the lives of all practitioners under the guidance of wonderful teachers here, beginning from His Holiness the Jivankamapa to the presence of an immediate teacher such as Khenpo Kata Rinpoche, as well as Khenpo Ujin Lama Lodro over here, as well as all of the teachers who are connected here, lay monks, nuns, lay, as well as the Sangha members, all the teachers who are otherwise come and teach over here. Through their blessings, through their guidance, each one of us find a way of being able to work with one's own self, making this life the very last that will come back again and again in this cyclic existence. But that while it is the last lifetime, that it is able to become a vehicle of liberation for all sentient beings. Such should be the aspiration, and that aspiration is not overtly optimistic simply because you can do it. There is only one, as I say always, thing between you and the fruition of such an aspiration, and that is one doubt, one hesitation. So that can't be too difficult. To overcome one thing can't be too very difficult. So in order to overcome that doubt and hesitation, hear the Dhamma properly, meditate, contemplate, investigate. Investigation is very important because that is the conviction that will transform and arise as confidence. So the meditation, investigation is important, and of course engaging is very important. So do your best and then work with your emotions. Don't let it be disturbing. So I always will try myself. You also try. And I also always say normally, let's see who does better at the end of the line. It's a journey we are all on together. And so I wish you all my very best. I wish to thank all of you, all of the directors and the staff members, as well as Sangha members and volunteers. So thank you all very, very much. On a personal front, I really want to say thank you to my good friend Sam and Nadia Scoggins, whose hospitality we've enjoyed very, very much over here. And I think the person behind the camera, the people who are working with the webcasting, thank you also very, very much. And I know during any kind of a visit, as well as running a large organization such as KTD, there are countless of people whose contributions are all very, very important and deeply appreciated. So thank you very, very much.